I might need that.
I mean, if I'm going to get roasted, I might throw up or something. I might need this bucket, you know. Thank you, Philip. Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. My name is Doug Mefford. I am an alcoholic. Thanks to the grace of a loving God, the 12 Steps and Alcoholics Anonymous strong sponsorship, folks like you haven't had a drink since August 15th of 1994, and I'm thankful for that period of sobriety tonight. And really glad to be with y'all. I fit best in a substitute role, I can tell you that. My ego demands that I'm a substitute rather than a primary selection, so it's not a problem for me to be the second choice. You know, there's only one person I'm the first choice of, and that's my mama. And I was her fourth, and she tells me, or told me often, that if I was a first, I'd be an only. So that kind of gives you an idea of the kind of guy I am. I'm just telling it how it is, you know. I do want all of you to pause and say a prayer for Burns. He's a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're here to hear the doctor, sorry. We'll see if I'm a sufficient substitute after a while. I know a vision for you says there is a sufficient substitute for alcohol, and it's this thing called the Fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's something that I've been afforded. And the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my experience, is a worldwide fellowship. For those of you that are new, those that were here just a year or less, standing up a few minutes ago, I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a valuable, valuable entity on the planet Earth, and you are now a member because you say you are. And with that membership comes friendships that you don't even know you have yet, with people that you don't even know yet, all over this world. You know, you got an international convention coming here to Atlanta. I say you, I do too. It's still you. I'm from Texas. I just relocated here a year ago. It's not home yet. I'm still getting used to the place. I see some familiar faces from the meetings I went to around and things of that nature while I've been here for the year that I've been here. But Atlanta's not home, so I'm still kind of, y'all are having a convention. We had a convention 5 years ago in San Antonio. Y'all are having one next year. And if you have never been to an international convention, you need to go. It is an amazing, amazing experience to go and to hold hands and pray with 50,000 plus recovering people in AA and Al-Anon. It's an amazing, amazing experience, and it really gives you an idea of just how powerful a thing that we belong to here. Now, I'm going to share a little story about what transpired for me at an international convention in San Antonio. We got out of the big meeting in the Alamo Dome, and you had to walk across a footbridge. For those of you that were there know what that is, and then you'd stand outside the convention center and smoke if you were a smoker. There's a big cloud of smoke that everybody walked through. If you're in AA, you kind of get it. You deal with it. You just walk through the smoke. That's the way it is. You know, when I came up in AA and you stand in a speaker meeting, a lot of times you had to duck below the boo haze so that you could see the crowd. But nonetheless, I'm standing out there smoking away, and this little guy comes up to me. He's a Middle Eastern Indian. His name is Lalu. And he starts talking to my wife and I, and we just struck up a conversation, and we exchanged information. And he went back to India. And he and I talked every 3 months, 4 months or so. He'd call, "Doug, it's Lalu." I had a hard time understanding him, but he'd say, and I'd respond, and we'd talk a little bit. I got laid off from the oil field job that I had, and I had to come to work in Atlanta. It was a job opportunity that came up. God brought me here. It wasn't my choice, but I'm here now doing the best I can with what I got. The job I got here affords me the opportunity to travel to India to go to work in the IT firm. So I'm sitting in Texas knowing I'm going to job, and I got to find Lalu's phone number, and I can't find it, and I can't find it, and I can't find it. I hadn't talked to him in like 6 months, and I'm thinking, man, I'm going to be going to India. I wonder if I'm going to be where Lalu is. And here it is, Friday, January 2nd. I'm leaving 8 a.m. the 3rd to head to Atlanta. And what happens? You know what happened. The phone rang. It was Lalu. And I said, "Hey, I'm going to work and I'm going to be traveling to India." And he says, "Where are you going?" "I'm going to be going to Bangalore." "Oh, that's where my city house is." Fantastic. So I end up traveling to India in August of last year. As I traveled to India, I got into Bangalore, I go to work. I call Lalu. He hooks me up with a local meeting at the Catholic Church, and I go over and I meet new friends I hadn't met yet. Had a ball with them, go out to tea in the local village and sit and drink tea for hours and talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. What an amazing deal. What an amazing deal. The common bond that we have, that we share, is amazing. So I did that, and then I was afforded the opportunity to go to dinner with Lalu and his wife one night. And then I took an overnight government bus trip in India, and if you've ever done that, it's an experience, I will assure you. And I pull into Chikmagalur, India, and Lalu owns coffee plantations, and I get to go up into the mountains and rainforest in India to his coffee plantation. And next door, he's got two village helpers at a neighboring plantation. And we go up on the top of the mountain where he goes to make cell phone calls in the rain. And these two visitors from next door who are 90 and 120 days sober come in and get in the back of his Jeep. And the four of us have an AA meeting on the top of a mountain in Chikmangaluru, India. And I was the only one that spoke English. And it worked just perfectly. What an amazing deal. What an amazing deal. And then we went down into town and they heard an American was coming to the meeting, and a group that usually has five had 25. And I got to stand up and give a lead on the first three steps and get translated into Hindi and have an experience. And then they had the remainder of the meeting, and I got to sit there as they spoke in Hindi, and I heard every word that they said, even though I didn't understand a word of it. Because the language of the heart does not have a barrier of the tongue. We feel each other here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We feel what God does for us and with us and through us if we are attuned to it. And my prayer on a daily basis is to open my eyes, my heart, and my awareness to opportunities to be of service and to allow my alcoholism to touch somebody else's alcoholism, or allow that my spirituality to touch some other spiritual being. Because I know today that I am a spiritual being having a human experience. And in my human experience, when I tap into my spirituality, what happens is I get to have the connections that I was never afforded before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I lived in the world of self-centered isolation that alcoholism brings. And there is no barrier greater than the self-centered isolation that alcoholism brings in my experience and what I've witnessed over the time I've been here. You know, and this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, the suitable substitute for the lifestyle, and it's vastly more than that. You know, I belong to a worldwide fellowship, and I embrace that worldwide fellowship. And I encourage any of you that are new or midstream or old in this thing called AA is embrace the worldwide fellowship and enjoy what it is you've been so freely given, and don't ever take it for granted. See, I also believe that it is a privilege and an honor to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not to just stand up here and be the show pig for tonight. You know, but to be a member, to be a card-carrying member in Alcoholics Anonymous, because there's lots of people around this planet that die that don't even get an opportunity to be exposed to AA. Because alcoholism is a killer illness, and I never want to lose sight of that. And I need to treat my illness on a regular and consistent basis if I'm to live long and happily. That's what my book tells me, and that's what I've been charged through sponsorship, through amends, and through what I believe my higher power's will for me is to be committed and connected to my recovery on a consistent and regular ongoing basis. All right, so that's enough of my soapboxing on some of that stuff. I guess what I need to do is tell you my sorry tale of woe so you understand that I belong here. So I'll start at the beginning. I was born at a very early age. I was the youngest of four in a very loving and close-knit family. You know, that family was as normal as anything can be. It was a Beaver Cleaverish type family. Dad went to work. Mom stayed home. We ate dinner every night at 5 o'clock. Did homework at the dinner table. Had sibling rivalries. Had a lot of love. Had a lot of camaraderie. Had a lot of sibling rivalry. Had a lot of fun. Had a lot of everything that you could imagine. A lot of love in that home. And I tell you that I came up in a home that was like that to identify that I am not an alcoholic as a byproduct of where I came from or what I was given or who my parents are or what I experienced as a lad. I'm an alcoholic as the sole byproduct of my choices and actions and the fact that I developed the allergy the doctor's opinion describes. I cannot control how much I drink once I start. That didn't happen right off the bat. I had the first taste of alcohol at the ripe old age of four. Now, I did not become a daily drinker at four. I want to assure you of that. I was not a knee-walking drunk at five or six. But what I did was beat my dad into submission as he's watching football with buddies. What do you got? What's that? What's that? What do you got? Can I have some? Let me have some. What do you got? What do you got? What do you got? I'm relentless, you know. I don't give up. I'm like the little chihuahua that's got a hold and I won't let go. And finally, he says, here. And he hands me a Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and I turned it up and I loved everything about it. Now, I'm sick. Pabst is nasty. I don't care who you are. I know the reason I loved it is because at that young age I wanted to be somebody else doing something else with someone else. Because I was riddled with fear and I didn't even know it. See, when I'm driven by fear, I do things that I think you want me to do, or I try to be something other than what I am or God intended me to be. Because fear is the inability for me to engage in my presence. It's the inability of me to be where I am and okay where I am. I can't live in fear, being driven by fear, and be where my feet are. I'm also not a guy that subscribes to fear and faith can't abide in the same house. That's not true. You know, our book talks about how we overcome fear. You know, and what it describes is all men of faith have courage. It doesn't say all men of faith don't have fear. See, and when I enlist my faith, what I get, I am granted is courage. And when I engage in that courage, I walk through the fear. And walking through the fear is something I had no capacity for doing when I was out there drinking and doing what I was doing. So nonetheless, I had that drink at 4, and then I rocked along till I held out as long as I could, being riddled and driven by fear. And at 12 years old, we had a planned event. It was a planned party. And I drank 8 Michelob beers, got room spinning sick. Say that fast a few times. I really promise I am sober. And I loved everything about it. And for me, it was the drink of consequence, because what happened that night is it opened up the obsession that our literature talks about. You know, literature talks about that we have an obsession of the mind coupled with a physical allergy. And the obsession was unleashed in my mind that night, because I was thinking about that drink. I was thinking about the next time I would, the last time I had, planning when I was going to, doing what I had to get away with whatever behavior problems I might be engaged in at the time so I didn't get grounded, so I could go out and do the drinking that I wanted to do. And that was the way it was until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for a little while after I got here, frankly. You know, I didn't become a daily drinker at 12. That was hard work. But I can tell you, I was enamored with the excitement and the planning and the coordination that was required in order to find the right person with the fake ID that could get us the booze so that we could do the job. And I loved what alcohol did for me. Because what it did for me was allow me to breathe. What it did was allow me to be where my feet were. What it did in my perception was to allow me to be bigger, better, brighter, faster, more funny, more good looking, more whatever, more of anything and everything I wanted to be in any given circumstance. And so I sought that at every given opportunity. I drank fast and furious. When I got out of high school, I was a drunk, plain and simple. I was drinking 4 or 5 nights a week, drunk every time I drank. If there wasn't enough to finish the job, I wouldn't do it. So nonetheless, when I graduated high school, I was a mama's boy, so I decided to go to the JUCO and play baseball. I went to play baseball at the junior college, and I did pretty well. Now, I'm a guy that changes my new best friends. Anytime I change my circumstances or situations, I have new best friends. Not in recovery, but before I got here, my new best friend was whoever I met wherever I ended up. And so I met my new best friends on the baseball team, and we established a little distribution business on the side, and we started doing work and playing baseball. And Coach caught wind of that opportunity, that business that we were running, and he decided he wanted to discuss things with Chris and Jeff and myself, and I knew immediately that there was trouble brewing. See, and when I know that trouble's brewing, I have an instinctual response. It's called lie, no matter what. To the death, never give up the truth. You know, if I'm confronted, you know, the funny thing is still today, almost 20 years of recovery, if I'm confronted with something, my first response instinctually is to lie. The cool thing about AA and these 12 steps is I have a built-in filter now. It doesn't fly out of my mouth like it used to. You know, it always used to just fly right out of my mouth. Now it might fire off in here. It just doesn't come out here. So I know what it's like to live honestly. So anyway, I go and sit down with Coach, and he tells me that I can't play for him anymore. And I was like, Coach, I'm the captain of the field. I'm the catcher. I've got a future. I've got a passion. You don't know what you're doing. You're destroying your team by making this decision. Really what I said to him was, okay, see, I'm a coward. I think big thoughts. I fight fights after the fact. You know, I'm that guy that I get in an argument with you, and I get home where I'm safe and distant from you, and then I build the fight in my head, and I beat you to a bloody pulp. Every time. Now, I never raised a fist to anyone because I was a coward. I was a chicken. But in my mind, you know, I am a legend in my own mind, and that's the way I built my legend, was whooping up on anybody that crossed me after the fact, you know, because I couldn't do it at the fact. So I told Coach, okay, because I couldn't say what I thought. And he asked me some questions, and then he set down some scenarios, and he asked me if I still wanted to play, and I said I did. Because I was going to go to a 4-year university and get my college education paid for. I had the potential to potentially go on to play some pro ball or minor league ball and so on and so forth. And one of the conditions that he had for me was to arrange a meeting between he and my parents. And really, I didn't have much of a future in baseball. I hadn't done much in baseball. I really didn't care much for baseball, and I really didn't need to be any part of that team. Thanks, but no thanks. Coach, I'll quit. And I did. Because I didn't know what he knew, and I didn't want him to tell my parents what he knew, because I'd been doing a real good job of leading the double life. You know, I build a web of deceit to get away with it. I build whatever I need to drive your perception so that I can do what I want to do, even though down in the pit of my stomach, in my heart of hearts, I know what I'm doing isn't right. But I'll do whatever I got to do so that I don't have to look at that. And as long as I can keep you at bay, I don't have to look at myself because I can't see the truth about me, or I'm unable. The delusion. It's not denial. I never had denial about alcoholism. I had delusion about the fact that I had problems. And delusion means that I have an altered state of reality. And my reality was, my life's okay. Just get the hell out of my way. That's it. Let me do what I'm doing. I don't need none of this stuff. So I ended up going home and I started my rat race on a full throttle downhill freight train run towards Alcoholics Anonymous after I had nothing other than drinking to take me out of me, because baseball did it and drinking did it. Now I don't have baseball, so all I do is drink. And I'm running around doing the deal. And that summer I put my parents through just literally hell on earth. You know, I was coming in at all hours of the night, gone a couple days at a time, so on and so forth. I remember one time coming in and Mom was on the couch at 5:30 and basically I was 20 years old and she grounded me. That didn't work real well for me, I can tell you. You know, and the grounding consisted of a midnight curfew. And I lived out in the far western suburbs of Chicago, and so what we do, we go out in the cornfields, knock down some corn, build a bonfire, and have a keg party. That's what we did. We used to say there was nothing else to do but that. That's how we justified it. And so the next night, my first night of grounding, we had a bonfire party, and I had to go. I had a reputation to uphold, of course. And so I went. Now, it doesn't get dark till like 9:30, you know, fire doesn't start till 10:30, kegs aren't rolling and girls aren't there till about 11:30, by 11:35, I got to leave. I'm grounded. Now, I can't tell anybody I'm grounded. I mean, really? I'm 20, party, keg, fire, grounded? No, I can't do that. But the other side of it is I don't know how to just leave. You know, I can't just go and disappear. I got to go around and tell everybody I'm leaving, you know. I'm going, I'm leaving, I'm good to see you, bye-bye, yeah, la, 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 la. You know, I'm a glad-hander, you know. I'm pressing the flesh with everybody saying bye, and they're all, where are you going? I had important business to attend to, of course. So I go home from the party, and I drive into the garage at my parents' house in my parents' car, and I go into my parents' house, up to their bedroom. Hey, I'm home. I made curfew. Okay, great, honey, thanks. I proceed to walk out of the bedroom, down the stairs, back into the garage, back into the car, back out to the party. It was after midnight. I thought we were starting curfew for the next day. And when I got home at 5:30 that morning, Mom wasn't buying the reset on the curfew idea. No, she was awake again. And we had a long talk. And I tell that story to describe what happened in the second portion of that talk. Second portion of that talk was when I pulled out every weapon of manipulation that I had at my disposal. I had some difficulties when we moved to that town, adjusting and getting engaged with some friends and so on and so forth, and all of those ramifications of puberty and all of that, right? And it was very difficult, and I was open with my mom at that, so I pulled that weapon out. You know, I had such a hard time making friends and meeting people, and what do you got to do? And it was literally a weapon, because what I wanted to do was stab her in the heart and make her feel bad for me so she'd leave me alone. The end of that hour conversation the next morning, I had my mother apologizing to me for grounding me at 20 years old. What a ridiculous expectation. Just please do better. You know, I'm thankful today. At that point, she was an untreated Al-Anon because she didn't put the screws to me. I was able to manipulate her. But I can tell you there was a lot of damage done in that relationship as a result of that continued battering of emotional manipulation and theft of peace and serenity that I'll never be able to completely repay. It's been restored, and I'll talk about that here in a little bit, I imagine. So nonetheless, I go away to the university that fall. When I go away to the university, my first semester, I didn't do so hot. I had a 0.92 grade point average. I see some folks shaking their head. Those are the, I'm imagining there's some Al-Anons that are thinking about their kids doing that, or maybe they're just kids themselves did it, and there's some laughing that might have done it themselves. I don't know, you know. So 0.92, I was on a stellar academic path, no doubt. I did an amazing thing the next semester. I actually attended class. When I attend class, I learn. I learn through listening. I got a 3.5 off probation. Everything's grand. Now, my drinking's just going. You know, third semester, same as the first, I'm back on probation. It's just not good. Fourth semester in. I'm drinking to live. I'm living to drink. I'm drinking to live. It's really to that point right now. I can tell you, I'm waking up every morning shaking. I'm the guy that's living by the motto of it don't matter. It don't matter is anything that really matters. The only thing that matters is drinking. I'm the guy, I'm the fail-safe for anybody that wants to go to the bar and drink. I get a call, hey Doug, what are you doing tonight? I said, I'm hanging out, I got a test in the morning. Well, you want to go to the bar? Sure. Wait a minute. You just said you had a test tomorrow. It don't matter. I'd go to the bar and drink. Me and Huey, we'd go to the bar on Sundays. Sunday was a great night to go to the bar, we thought. We thought the girls that went to the bar on Sunday were looking for guys. So we went to the bar on Sunday. I went to the bar every day. But Sunday had a special purpose. The problem is, when I arrived at the bar on Sunday, I started to imbibe in Budweiser. That was my drink of choice. The problem happens when I imbibe in Budweiser, I forget her. I forget the objective. I forget the purpose until last call. So I have been drinking Budweiser from 3 in the afternoon until 1 a.m. on last call. And then I realize, aha, her, I forgot. And I have my two 16-ounce last call Budweisers and my frosty mugs. I probably have some puke on my shoes and spittle on my shirt. And I see her, and I lock in.
Hi, you doing? You're beautiful.
You come home with me like, I never got her to come home with me. I didn't know until I got into AA, I needed to find an untreated Al-Anon at that bar at closing time and walk up to her and just say this, I need you. I would have been great. I would have been perfect. But I had no awareness that that was what was necessary. I couldn't find the untreated Al-Anon, and I didn't know the key phrase to get it. But I know now. So if I ever relapse, look out. I'm going to find her. I'm going to tell you that right now. Woo! I ain't going to tell a lie. I know the key word to get taken care of.
I need you.
Corey knows. I've heard enough Al-Anon speakers to know that that's an absolute truth. Nonetheless, so I didn't get girls. I didn't have any problems because I didn't care, really. I was drinking and doing what I was doing. Fourth semester, get back to that. 7 weeks in, passed ad drop. I needed to quit because I got a 12-hour class load and I got to write a 25-page paper. Now, 12-hour class loads, 10 hours a week in the classroom. 10 hours a week is an awful large commitment. How do you really expect me to uphold 10 hours of class and write a 25-page paper to get an incomplete off my record from last semester? Really? Uh-uh. So I quit. Now, I didn't just leave. I had to go to all of my professors because I wanted to keep my great academic profile. I asked them all for W's instead of fails because I didn't want to flunk out of college. I just wanted to withdraw gracefully. So I went to each of them and I said, I need to quit because I've got my girlfriend pregnant and I need to get a job to pay for the baby. Y'all know I didn't have a girlfriend. I couldn't get her no matter what, you know. But nonetheless, that's why I had to quit. And my parents are having meetings about me at this point, and they're talking about what are we going to do about him, it, and that. You know, they have a command performance. I show up. They go to the next room, and they start talking about me like I'm not there, and I'm not invited to participate. I don't get any say in what they're talking about here. And my aunt comes to the rescue and says, hey, you know what? Doug can come live with us in Nashville. And they presented me with that idea, and I thought, woohoo, all right, we're going to go. Because if I can just get away from these losers at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, I can rock it on to the rest of my life and do everything that I have in store in front of me. I can take the world by the cuff and just go. I've been told my whole life I got potential. I got potential to be anything I want, go anywhere I want, do anything I want, be anyone I want. I got the potential to do it all. Now, I took a good sponsor in AA to teach me what potential means. For those of you that are new or for those of you that are unsure, potential means you just hadn't done anything yet. And that was me. See, because I'm living by fear. I'm living driven by fear. And that's why I don't do anything. See, I was afraid to fail so much to the core of my being that I was afraid to succeed because ultimately I would succeed beyond my capacity to maintain, thereby fail. So because I'm unwilling to accept the gifts that God gave me and pursue what He has put in front of me with everything in me, I settle for less than what God has in store. And then I'm resentful at what I don't get. I'm resentful at how the world treats me. I'm resentful at the fact that I'm not getting my just due. But when I'm really looking at the truth, I'm not putting forth the effort to get any of it. I deserve exactly what I got in that moment in time. So I ran away to Nashville. Now it was a setup. She was a certified drug and alcohol counselor. They stacked the deck against me. They put me to work at Nashville Wine and Spirits, the liquor store. I got discounts. And that was a fine wine shop. And I can tell you, when I crossed the threshold of that wine shop to sell those high-dollar bottles of wine to the Southern Society folks in Nashville, Tennessee, there had not been a drop of wine past these lips that had ever seen a grape before. Mad Dog, Thunderbird, Night Train, those kinds of things, they don't come from grapes. Screw-off bottles were not on the shelves at Nashville Wine and Spirits. They had corks, and they expected you to describe the tannin aftertaste and how it would cleanse your palate with this food and that food, and whites go with this, and Riesling with that, and Cabernet, and blah, 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 wah, 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 wah. I don't have any idea why anyone would spend $350 on a 10-glass bottle of wine. I can't get drunk on 10 glasses of wine. I damn sure ain't spending $350 for that. It just ain't going to happen. I can get a lot of Budweiser for $350. I ain't going to lie. But I can't tell you I don't know what I'm doing. I'm an expert. As soon as I cross the threshold, I am a fine wine connoisseur of the highest order. And all I got to do is listen to you and spew what I spew. You see a lot of that in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we? We see a lot of people that come in and they listen. They open their ears real well. And they talk the talk. They spit out the stuff out of the book. But when you examine the life a little bit closer, it's in shambles in every way, shape, and form because they're not walking the walk. And my sponsor tells me on a regular and consistent basis, always remember, Doug, that your walk talks louder than your talk talks. You have to do what you say you're doing, or what you say means absolutely nothing at all. And so I try to practice that to the best of my ability. But I wasn't then. I was doing what I was thinking was right. We went to a wine tasting, and this is the alcoholic ego personified. The inability to say, I don't know, please help, or show me, is not in my vocabulary because I know everything there is to know about everything there is to know about anything. Just ask me. We go to the wine tasting to sell a new line, and I sit in the middle of five. It's a place about this big, and I'm about in the position that I'm in now, and I'm in the center so I can observe. They take the cork out of the bottle, and the guy's describing this wine and its age and so on and so forth, and they pass the wine cork down, and they smell it. And these guys start describing it, and I smell it, and I start describing it like they described it. Now, I just smelled cork, but I described what they described. Because, I mean, I have a reputation, you know. I mean, come on. So then they pour the glasses, and everybody picks it up, and I start to swirl because that's what they do, and I just got to fit in because I got to belong because I can't not know anything. And so it's breathing, breathing. Wine's breathing. It's got to breathe so you can taste it. And then everybody takes a big swish. I've used mouthwash. I know how to swish. I'm swishing away. Swishing, swishing, swishing. Then the damnedest thing I ever saw happen in my whole life happened. Y'all are getting ahead of me. They got a big old paper bucket down there, and they spit the wine out, and I'm just like, oh my God, they're going to know that I don't know what I'm doing because I have already swallowed the wine. I don't understand why you'd spit out perfectly good alcohol. That is alcohol abuse. The only time alcohol left this body after I put it in was an involuntary response to what went in, I can tell you. There was no purposeful spitting, ever. But can I say, I've swallowed the wine? No, I puff up my cheeks full of air, and when the bucket comes to me, I and pass it along. See, because I am so insecure, I am so inferior, I am so afraid of what you think of me, that I can't be anything other than what I think that you want me to be. And that's the way I lived my life, was the chameleon, being what it is that I thought you wanted me to be, rather than the guy God intended me to be. Because I never even knew who I was. I had no idea where I was going or what I was doing most of the time in my drinking life. Now, I got to go to the bar with Stan. Stan was my new best friend. Now, Stan and I went to the bar, and Stan was a musician. We drank some beers. We drank one or two beers, and Stan said, I got to go to band practice. I said, Stan, we're drinking. He says, Doug, I've drank. I said, Stan, we're drinking. He says, no, I've drank. I got to go to band practice. I said, Stan, we're drinking. Drinking. Drank. Drinking. Drank. Went this way for about 5 minutes, and Stan says, I got to go. And he left. He left. We were drinking, and he left me. I don't like to drink alone. Only problem drinkers drink alone. But now I have no choice because I've taken the trigger dose. I got to finish the job. So I just start doing it. And I hate Nashville now. I hate it. Can't stand being here. I need to be with my old people. I need to be with my people. I need to be back in DeKalb at Northern with my guys, my people. And I start longing to be back because I have the first inkling there may be a problem. It's the first crack. Now, my niece was born, and I decided I'm going to go back to Chicago to see her, and I stop off in Indianapolis to see the Grateful Dead for 3 days with those old friends. And that leads me to what happened. And what happened is important. What happened is an important part of every AA story. Because they're all different. But there's all something in common. Some are very quick, some are very sharp, some are very long and drawn out. Mine was long and drawn out. My what happened was, on the second night I overindulged in a great number of things. I had a white light near-death experience. I came out of that near-death experience a paranoid delusional psychotic. Now that psychosis manifested itself in me with the FBI, the CIA, the TEA, the ATF, and all those federal people were after me. It was serious bad. You know, I was paranoid. Paranoid to the point, you know, not peeking through the mini blinds, not hanging tinfoil on the window. No. Paranoid going to the football field, 50,000 of my closest friends thinking they're talking about me in the huddle. Paranoid. It was bad. And I'm divulging secrets for 6 days trying to rid myself of the paranoia and it won't go away. And at the end of that 6 days, I'm standing in my brother's house shucking and jiving, postponing and evading. Because my delusion has me saying, if I don't turn myself in to become a narc, that's my delusion. I can't do that. Not the honor among thieves of my life. I can't do that. If I don't do that, I'm going to jail. And I'm not fit for jail. I wasn't made for jail. Can't go to jail. So I just don't know what I'm going to do. I'm standing in his house postponing as long as I could, and I looked at him after he's turning the screws of pressure, and he knows. He's sober 6.5 years in AA. He knows what's going on. And he says, you got to go, and I look at him, a last-ditch effort to relieve the paranoia, and I said, Rob, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know what to do about it. He said, you just took the first step. I didn't take the first step. The first step is on the page 30 of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first step on page 30 says, we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. The idea that we may someday some be like other people has to be smashed. All I did was say some words. I uttered some words, but those words set up a series of events that led me to you. The next morning, my life was literally in the balance. I had a plan exactly how I was going to kill myself, and thankfully I didn't do it. My mom dialed the phone to Mercy Center Treatment Program, and they answered, and they would see me right then. And I went into the Mercy Center Hospital in North Aurora, Illinois. I weighed 150 pounds, and my blood pressure was 220 over 170, and I was psychotic as a jitterbug. See, that's where my choices and actions take me. Psychotic, emaciated, and about to pop. See, I don't want to never forget that morning. Because it's a real killer illness, and it's serious what happens to us. It's all fun, and we can laugh about it now, and it is fun, and it is funny. It's important. The laughter of love is so important in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love to hear the laughter because it's what heals that pain and those deep-set wounds that we come here with. That laughter releases that grace to be able to be grabbed and taken a hold of so that we can live this life God has in store for us. So I went into that treatment center, and for 15 days I was psychotic. I was in the nut hut. At 6 months of sobriety, I found out that I was actually 6 days to be certified. 6 days before I was to be sent to the state court and be sent to the state mental institution, the psychosis broke. Why am I here with you? I don't think I'm chosen, special, or anything. What I believe is I'm just a guy that's lucky, just plug lucky. And I don't ever want to look that lucky horse in the mouth. I want to take advantage of everything that's been afforded me. So I got on fire with treatment after one last little shebang. I failed the UA and I lied about it because that's what I do. I lie. A man from Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was lying, came up and he told his story. He talked about what he was thinking, feeling, and doing 8.5 years prior when he sat in the chair I sat in. And how could he know those things about me? How could he know that? How could he know? I've never met that man before in my life. They've been spying on me. I swear to God, they've been spying on me. He's been reading my mail. He knows me. He knows exactly what I'm thinking, exactly what I'm feeling, exactly what I'm doing. I'm sitting in the treatment center pissed off. And I think it's nothing more than a con. It's a money game. All these people read all this crap in a book and tell me they don't know what my life's like. That's all I'm doing. You know, I've got my mom's big book at my house that I threw across her kitchen table in one of those rants after a day in treatment. But this man, he afforded me the opportunity that I needed. He afforded me what I believe is the opportunity every alcoholic needs to get and stay sober in AA. He afforded me the opportunity to identify. Identification. book talks about recovery begins when one alcoholic shares with another his experience, strength, and hope. And that's what he did. He shared the language of the heart. His alcoholism touched my alcoholism. And as a result of that and that process of identification, I got just a smidgen of hope. I'm still lying about it. And 2 days later, I'm laying in my bed thinking of the story to get away with it just one last time. And while I'm laying there, I have the moment of clarity. The end of my truly what happened. When I sat up in my bed and I physically saw my life for what it was a lie, a farce, a story, a con game. And I didn't like what I saw. And I threw my hands physically in the air and I said, God, please help me. I don't want to live like this anymore. See, I didn't say, God, please help me not to drink. See, folks, I don't have a drinking problem. I never had a drinking problem. I will never have a drinking problem. I have alcoholism. And there's a big damn difference. Drinking problems, sufficient reason will allow me to stop a drinking problem. Alcoholism, I do not have the needed power to change course, no matter what, of my own accord. Alcoholism is a living problem in which that alcohol is a solution until that solution no longer works. And generally speaking, the alcoholic dies. We are a few that have been afforded the opportunity not to die. Don't take this for granted. I'm dead serious about this thing called AA. I am dead serious about this thing because it kills people every single day. And I don't ever want to lose sight of that. And I don't want my daughter to die. I don't want it to not be here for her. I'm a purist when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and keeping this thing singular in purpose and focused to solution so that we can have alcoholism that we have touch alcoholism of others and bring them into the fold and we can build this fellowship continuously. It's the only reason we're here. There's only one reason for Alcoholics Anonymous existence, to be self-perpetuating through carrying the message that the alcoholic still suffers. And I want to be a participating member in that at every given opportunity, and I do that. So needless to say, I went to treatment the next morning. I told Marge the truth of what I had done, and I felt what it felt like to be honest for the first time, and it was amazing. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on Friday night, August the 20th, 1994. And that man that was at that treatment center Tuesday was there, and I ran up to him. I said, Daryl, would you be my sponsor? Because that's what they told me I needed to do. I got a sponsor at my first meeting of AA. And I cried throughout that meeting, and afterwards we talked, and he set the terms. He was a good, effective sponsor. He set down the terms. He told me what AA was and was not, what a sponsor was and was not. And he sealed the deal with asking one simple question, are you willing to go to any length for victory over the alcohol? For lack of a better answer, I said yes. It seemed like he wanted that answer, and I'm proficient at giving you what you want, in my perception. So I said yes. He said, okay, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, well, it's Saturday. I'm off treatment. I'm going to probably sleep in, do a little laundry, watch some TV, relax, and be good to myself. And he said, I don't think so. He said, you will set your alarm for 5:30 in the morning. You will report to Rick at Cool Acres Park and help out the fellowship's annual pig roast. I didn't know you can change sponsors. I didn't know you could say no. And I'm standing behind this podium tonight as a result of that God-given ignorance. See, because I was given my first God the gift of desperation. And that desperation availed me the opportunity to do exactly what that man asked of me. And I did it. And what happened is I was given a precious gift the next morning. The next morning I went and did what I was asked to do. I asked, what could I do? They asked me to help with this and with that and the other thing. And then I ended up in the food line after boiling corn and having a vat of butter. And I'm standing behind the counter as people are walking through at this fellowship picnic. And I'm dipping an ear of corn in a vat of butter and I'm slapping it on their plates. And Chico and Janet and John and Shelley and Sherry, Daryl and Denny and Louie, and all of these other people walked through that line and they said, Doug, they remembered my name. It's good to see you. God, I believed what they said. We're glad you're here. Seriously? Me? Keep coming back. And the fellowship hooked me. And the reason it was such a precious gift is because I was of service. See, Bob talked in his last talk, he boiled it down to really two simple things, love and service. Love and service, that's all I got. That's it. That's all I got. And because I was of service at that early age of sobriety, what happened in serving you, I was given the freedom to break free of the self-centered barrier of isolation. And the gift of God's grace washed over to me as it was extended to me by the fellowship. Without service, I don't get that gift because I can't grab a hold of it because I got the wall between me and you. But when I do service work, the wall comes down, and that allows you to come in. And when you come in, your alcoholism touches my alcoholism. The gift of God's grace can touch my heart, and I have an opportunity to change. I have an opportunity to go forward on a different trajectory. That's exactly what happened. Daryl and I rocked along, started doing the steps, and my life got good. And I was going to treatment centers. I was going to jails. I was sponsoring guys. I was 24 years old. I was 22 when I got sober. I'm 23 and change the first time I got a sponsee. My first sponsee at 23 and a half have done nothing in my life. My first sponsee was a 53-year-old retired grandfather. He's still sober today. See, this doesn't matter. The common bond cuts through all. Now, he's not sober as a result of me. He's sober as a result of him and God. But the message was conveyed. It doesn't matter. There's no barriers here in how this message conveys. There's no class. There's no differentiation. There's no age. There's no socioeconomic. There's nothing but alcoholism. And when we talk about alcoholism and the solution to that alcoholism, it breaks all those barriers down. Breaks them all down. And allows us to be in communion with one another. It allows us to be in a true fellowship and overcome the bedevilments that page 52 talks about. So I was rocking along, doing a good deal. I'm 2 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks sober, and I go to Texas because I'm dating her long distance and I want to see where it'll go. So I moved down to Texas. I got to Texas. I got an idiot for a sponsor when I got there. They didn't do it right in Texas when I got there. And I got an idiot for a sponsor. Guy was not objective. He didn't give me very good direction. He didn't really hold me accountable to any standard of behavior like I had been used to at that point. He didn't have me have a committed meeting schedule or a regular call-in time or any of that stuff. He didn't have me have any of the structure that I needed through sponsorship accountability to grow. And in 10 months, I got resentful, dishonest, manipulative, and afraid. I started heading towards, I trashed the relationship that I was in. I was headed towards picking up a drink. I almost lost the job that I went down there to do. And I'm going to tell you, that idiot as a sponsor is the guy you're looking at right now. Alcoholism. The ISM stands for, I sponsor myself. And if you want the isms, get after it. And I'm going to tell you, if you don't have a sponsor, you're an idiot. You are not availing yourself to the most valuable tool that this fellowship offers in my experience. That's not an opinion. That's my experience. My sponsor holds me to a standard of behavior that I'm unable to attain of my own accord. He expects more of me than I expect of myself. And he shows me how to do what I need to do to live this life. He doesn't just tell me. I'm a guy that's submitted to the authority of another human being and the accountability of a sponsor. And I tell him yes when he asks. Period. I don't argue, I don't debate, because sponsorship in my experience is a spiritual relationship. And if God's in the center of the relationship and I trust in God, then I need to trust in that sponsor as one of God's vehicles to carry His message to me and do what He has for me to do. See, my sponsor's never asked me to do something that's going to cause me harm. And I trust that implicitly. And if you don't have that level of trust in your sponsor, start doing the work to earn it, gain it, have it, or find somebody that you do have it with. Because trust is critical in that relationship. I trust that man implicitly. And I'm benefited for it. So we rocked along. Stuart and I started doing this deal, and I got back involved doing this, doing that, going to jails, going to treatment. I'm serving coffee at the area, and here comes this little GSR from the Mid-Cities group in Texas. She's kind of cute. I liked her. Now, I started to pursue her. Now, I am a social retard at the time. My pursuit of this girl that I liked was pulling her hair, poking her in the arm, trying to trip her as she's walking down the hall, that kind of stuff. You know, like high school flirtiness. That was me. Now, obviously, the holes in her head fit the horns in mine because we're married 15 years now. But that's the way it started. She went and asked her sponsor if we could have a relationship. And her sponsor said, no sex for 6 months. And she brought that to me, and I said, okay. She said, no, you don't seem to understand. No sex for 6 months means no holding hands, no touching, no hugging, no rubbing, no feeling, no nothing for 6 months. And I thought, that's kind of drastic. I brought that to my sponsor. Here's the description or the identification of effective sponsorship. I went to sponsor, this is the direction her sponsor gave her, and she said to me that was the case, and I think that's a little drastic. And sponsor says back to me, you said you wanted to get to know her, correct? I said, yeah. Her sponsor has heard her fifth step, correct? Yeah. So her sponsor probably knows what's necessary in order for her to get to know somebody, right? Yeah. Then I suggest you follow that direction. Okay. It's just that simple. Doesn't have to be harsh. Doesn't have to be hard. Doesn't have to be difficult. It's just that simple. And I did that. And I can tell you, in the 4.5 months, per her sponsor's repeal, 6 weeks early, in the 4.5 months, I always say that. I've said it. I remember one time I was talking, I said, and then I never learned anything that I needed to know about my wife after the first 4.5 months. And everybody just, blew. So I add that, by her sponsor's repeal. You know, I follow direction. It's important. We've been together 16 years and change. 15 of that has been married. I've learned nothing of material significance that would change my view on who or what this woman is about, how she thinks, what she does, since the first 4.5 months that we were together. Nothing of material significance has been learned in the subsequent 16 years. That's amazing to me, because when you can't touch, all you can do is talk and 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 talk. I could do that 4.5 months, because that's all we did, was talk. But we talked about everything that had meaning. We talked about our principles, values, behaviors, hopes, wishes, dreams, spirituality, God, love, religion, everything that you could fathom, kids, parents, family, illness, age, everything. I mean, any topic, we talked about it. We talked about it at depth. It's the foundation of our marriage, because we invited God into that communication. I'm so thankful for that process today. I am so thankful for that process today. About 2 years after we were married, her dad fell off the roof of his house and our son turned. I had a stepson in the marriage. He turned 13 and woke up an entirely different human being that morning. And he started his path towards us. She was gone to deal with her dad as a brain injury patient, having been in a coma and then coming out of it and so on and so forth. And we're trying to get pregnant when we see each other. She's physically absent when she's gone. She's emotionally absent when she's there. And I get a resentment at God because I'm not getting the baby that I thought I deserved on my own timeline. And I get resentful at the source of my power. I pull out my big chief tablet and I start keeping score. And when I'm the scorekeeper in that sense, you lose every time. And so we ended up getting pregnant, but it was too late because I'm resentful at God. When the baby was born on December the 18th, our son had been arrested 2 months prior, was in jail for the first time at 17 years old. My wife takes the baby at a week old up to see her brother on Christmas Day. It was a difficult, difficult time. And to add insult to injury, on February the 10th, I went to her and said, I don't want to be married to you anymore, and I left. 2 months after everything I'd ever wanted was given to me, I left. See, because when I'm resentful at the source of my strength, I'm not seeking God's will. And when I'm not seeking God's will, I live in self-will. And while I live in self-will, I destroy everything that has value in my life. I don't have to pick up a drink to do that. 10 years sober, I left. 10 years sober, I'm sicker than rain. Not living by spiritual propulsion, living by self-will and driven by fear. Expectations unfulfilled lead to resentment. When I got resentment, it eats me alive. And I take selfish and self-centered actions no matter how long I've been here. It does not matter. I have to live spiritually or I will die. Plain and simple. So I leave. And I spend 6 months working through the steps with my sponsor, 4, 5, 6, and 7 primarily. Inventorying this marriage, inventorying myself until I finally discover that I'm resentful at God for not delivering the baby that I wanted on my schedule. He gave me exactly what I wanted, but He didn't do it in my timeline. Does not He know who I am? And because I am so arrogant, because I am so egotistical, because I am so demanding, because I am so expectant, I almost throw it all away at 10, 11 years sober. Not drinking, the wife and the child. I filed for divorce. That's why I didn't go to Toronto in 2005. Because I was fixing to get a divorce. But through being a service to Alcoholics Anonymous and being principled in that difficult time, most of the time in AA, boy and girl, same home group, meet on AA campus, they go out, they break up. Whoever gets to the home group first wins. Story's out first, hit the press, that's it. There's no defense. We didn't have that. We shared a home group. There were people in our home group who didn't know we were separated because we practiced these principles in rough going. We carried each other with dignity and grace and respect in the public eye. We were of service to the Texas State Convention in the hospitality room. And when we were serving food, I sensed a familiar comfort with my wife through being a service to AA. She asked me the next day if I had any thoughts or feelings about what we could do to keep the family together, and I said, yes, I have, and we actually reconciled 4 days later. We've been together since, and I'm so thankful the things that I would have missed if I had not been open to do the work that my sponsor asked of me to discover and discard the resentment at the source of my power. Over the last handful of years, things have been good and bad. That son got out of jail. He came back to live with us. He went back into jail. He got out of jail. He came back to live with us. He got sober. I remember standing at the Irving Spring Conference in 2009. I'm standing at the podium. My young daughter, my granddaughter at that time, my son, my wife, his girlfriend are all in the front row. And it's like an out-of-body experience as I'm telling my story behind one of these podiums. And it's like, man, how good is life? How great is God? How awesome is this deal? Everybody's sober, happy, and whole. We're all together. We're all doing this deal, pursuing God's will, and it was a really cool deal. 3 weeks later, those two kids who had that baby had never taken a legal drink together in the bar, so they put the baby in the crib, let the baby go to sleep, and then they went to the bar and drank. And me and my wife had to go take that baby because we had to be her voice. And we took her for a period of time, and then the other grandparents took her. We had them sign her away for a year at least. And they had some conditions before they could get her back, and it was tough. It was tough sledding. Wasn't as tough as it was going to get, because within a short order of time, because he's a drug addict, he's out there shooting a needle of heroin in his arm on a regular basis. And I'm living life in sobriety, committed in Alcoholics Anonymous, loving God, being peaceful, serene, and happy, joyous and free to the best of my ability while I'm walking around this earth doing this deal, hoping for the best and planning a funeral. These principles work in rough going, folks. It doesn't matter what difficulty comes. If you cheerfully capitalize it, I didn't cheerfully capitalize it, but I did capitalize on it as an opportunity for God to demonstrate His omnipotence, because He is. And He walked us through that, and that kid ended up getting arrested and going to big boy jail. He went to prison for multiple years. He's out now doing his deal, and he's doing seemingly a little bit better, but it was a rough sled. But I learned a lot in that process at 10 years sober to not then take inventory of my wife and keep score. And she and I tended to our relationship as we went through that difficult time and process as our boy is in prison. And our young daughter's coming up, and we don't know how to live. We don't know what to do, but we're doing what we can, the best that we can, staying active in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and loving one another and being committed to our relationship. A year and a half ago, October, I get a call. My sister, my brother who's sober, 26 years, just last week. He's married. His wife's been basically popping pills since breast cancer. Untreated alcoholism in the house, and she decides she's going to drink. 6 steps up the stairs, she has a blackout event, falls, crushes her skull, and she ends up in the hospital in ICU. And my brother is not an active participant in his recovery. He's one of those guys that's a thief. He took the gifts of sobriety and ran away with them. He didn't have a network like I do, so I became his network. He was a guy that when his butt fell off, AA was his butt glue. He'd go in, get his butt glued on, and he'd go back to doing what he was doing. A lot of people like that. Recreational AA members. Recreational AA members that use AA as butt glue. And he was doing that. Now he had devastation in his life and he didn't know what to do. And he called me and I told him, you're an alcoholic. You need to go to a meeting and ask a new guy what you can do to help him, because it's the only way to get over the difficulty that's sitting on you. And I was afforded the blessing and opportunity to basically sponsor my older brother. God's gift was objectivity through that process, and I sponsored him through the death and burial of his wife. It was a tough, tough time, but man, what an honor that I got that opportunity. 4 weeks ago tonight, Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, 29 members of the Mefford and Allen family are gathering at my father's house, because 2 days prior, my mother had died. I left on Wednesday night to go because she was going to have quadruple bypass surgery due to the results of prolonged heart disease, and all was well. My mom got to Al-Anon 2 days before, basically right when I went in the hospital. When I went to the hospital, she went to Al-Anon. And we walked this path together for those first 2 years that I lived there. We walked that path and we went to dinner every week. And we went to the same place and we went to the same meetings. And we knew the same people and we engaged in the fellowship and the recovery through the 12 steps. And a relationship was restored beyond its damage and built anew. We had a friendship. I went on Wednesday night and I sat down with my mom, and my mom knew that we were going to get up that latter part of spring break and wake up our daughter early in the morning on that Thursday and drive to the Magic Kingdom to surprise her at the most magical place on earth. And 3 weeks before, my mom had an angiogram and found out there was blockage, and so she needed to have surgery, and they scheduled it for that morning. We were supposed to go to the most magical place on earth. And I decided I needed to go. Because if something bad happened, I didn't want to not be there. And I drove up on Wednesday night, and I sat there in my mom's house, and she said, I'm glad you're here.
I am so thankful you came. She didn't want to see me a lot when I was drinking. For 19 years, we had a relationship that is beyond my understanding and really beyond my deserves for the way that I treated that woman, the theft of her peace and serenity, the manipulation that I did. But these principles cut through the barriers that were there and allowed us to restore that relationship. On Thursday morning, we went to the hospital, and all reports were well every hour through the surgery until it wasn't well anymore. We went into the locked room, and the surgical nurse came up and said, "We've encountered a problem." It was me, my dad, and my sister. I stepped out of the room, and I called my sponsor. He said, "Doug, you serve. That's what God put you there for, is to serve." And I said, "Yes, sir." I walked back in that room. That surgical nurse came back in, and she said, "I'm sorry. We're not going to be able to save her." My sister crumbled right there in front of me, hyperventilating, dropped to her knees. My dad can't control himself. And the most amazing calm I have ever experienced came over me. I stood there, and I picked them up in my arms, and I just held them. God is awesome when I engage. God will give me exactly what I need to serve those around me at every given moment, no matter what. See, I'm a selfish and self-centered human being to the core, and most of the time, most every time I see something happen around me or to me, my first instinctual thought is, how's that going to affect me? Because I'm just that selfish. The first time in the consciousness of my sobriety, that Thursday morning that my mother went to be home with the Lord, I didn't have that thought. I didn't have that thought. And it happened dead to me. And I didn't think, how's this going to affect me? That's how great God is. He will give me that peace to be of service and to stand forth and be what He wants me to be in the given moment. I am so thankful to you and the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous for affording me those opportunities in my life to restore the relationships, to be the good son, to be the good brother, to be the good dad, to be the good husband, to do the best I can a day at a time to do what I believe God would have me do, because that's all I can do. I pray on a daily basis. I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than Peter loved the Lord. I kid you not. And if you screw with it, I'm going to fight you to the death. I don't ever want to forget my mom and the relationship that we had. I carry her 15-year Al-Anon chip. I think about the seconds and inches that maybe would have stopped us. There was an old man in Texas who used to talk about that. I think about this Buffalo nickel I carry in my pocket. It's a 1935 Buffalo nickel. This 1935 Buffalo nickel is a reminder of just how close we came for me not to be here. This nickel represents the nickel dropped in the phone by Bill Wilson in the Mayflower Hotel when he called Dr. Bob. And why did he call Dr. Bob? Not to save another alcoholic. He called Dr. Bob to save his own ass. I come to you in Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis in order to give. And when I give, I get. And when I give, I get. I give in order to receive. And I receive in great measure beyond my ability to give. I will never outgive what I receive. But if I stay given, the receipts will add up. And my ability to stay and give some more will be extended. See, I love Alcoholics Anonymous with every fiber of my being, and I pray every day, God, please show me the opportunities to be of service and give me the fortitude to do the service that you present for me to do. At the end of the day, I thank God every day for allowing me another day of sobriety, and I thank you and the members of Alcoholics Anonymous for introducing me to that God that gives my life purpose, value, and meaning. I can tell you, I don't always know what God's will is not, and I don't know always what God's will is. But I believe the picture that God paints for me and His will for me as it relates to my relationship with Him is of paramount importance. And what I believe that is expressed as is God would like for me to make Him my first choice rather than my last resort. And if He is my first choice, I have nothing to fear. Thanks for letting me be here.